Hi there, and welcome to our book talk on the book A Brave New World. I am Katie.
I'm Kayla.
I'm Ellie.
And we are going to get started talking about just some of the general knowledge you need to know about the book. Who's going to start off with the era?
Well, we can start off by saying the only thing more complicated than the book is the author's name.
Yeah.
Aldous Huxley. So don't be worried. If you can pronounce his name, then you can read the book just fine.
And if you can't, pick a different book. Anyways, going into the era, I think it's important to note that A Brave New World was written in the 1930s in the shadow of the First World War. When I read an article about The Guardian, they kind of talked about how even though it's centered in the future, specifically in 2450 AD, he kind of writes the book within the shadow of, like, the Wall Street crash and the devastating flu virus. And at that time, the Treaty of Versailles also carved out this new Europe, which brought in electricity, the automobile, production lines, new mass media, and aeroplanes were changing the world. Katie?
So we're kind of in the 1929 stock market crash, you know?
It's right before the
depression hits. Kind of in the midst of the storm.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm saying.
And a big thing to remember is that at this time, science and technology was promising this brighter future. And in Aldous Huxley's own opinion, he kind of adapted this and made it this idea that maybe technology isn't the best route for humanity. Yeah.
So let's move on to setting. It's in a place called the World State, and it's in England.
Yeah, the World State is pretty much centered within England, and everything within England has changed from, like, the Charing Cross Station in London has become the Charing Tea Tower, and the crosses have been placed with the T of the Ford's Model T car, which kind of just symbolizes how technology is now running that world.
Right, assembly line.
Yeah.
And you kind of get into the... just, like, you can note the power of the Great Depression.
It gave people a brighter future for technology.
Yeah. Right, and it affected everyone on a worldwide scale. We're not just looking at a single nation. You can see the effects of the era on every, multiple parts of the world.
Yeah, overseas. The thing about the Great Depression is people were so focused on just, like, working and surviving to make ends meet, and the entire premise of the Brave New World Society is that people kind of just work, but it's more important to them to, like, just have fun and have that instant gratification and, like, not to focus on, like, any stressors in life.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, like, I guess could be seen as an escape.
Yeah.
At face value.
And also, if we go back up, another point of the setting is in New Mexico at the Savage Reservation. Yeah. So we could start talking about that one.
Well, I think that's interesting because you had said how the Great Depression affected everybody. And I feel like he took New Mexico and showed it how it was this reservation where savages were still alive. And in the sense, it was almost like these people and customs of the Savage Reservation were modeled loosely on, like, the traditions of Native Americans, and it kind of, like, allowed the novel to contrast all historical societies, and, like, from this article, it said from the Neolithic era to Huxley's own with the Society of the World State, so New Mexico was even affected, but in a completely different way, because it was almost like this little dome for people to just watch what they used to be live.
And it's important to note that everyone's made in a lab.
So people are made to be the semi-morons. Yeah. So
down to the point where, like, they'll, like, inject, like, alcohol into, like, the baby's cells, like, to, like, really stunt their growth or, like, you know, like, there's just so much manipulation just to have them come out a certain way. Mm-hmm. It's also important to note that they make people in batches. Yeah. So, like, you could have, like, 100 twins, all of you guys the same, coming out, like, so you take
lack of diversity.
Yeah. And I feel like that's kind of where the whole genre of the book comes. Like, it's this utopian but also dystopian novel with a bit of science fiction, which is kind of an interesting... I feel like that's a really
But really isn't science fiction, because today, like, you get into things like that's gene therapy, so...
But I would say in the 1930s it was definitely science
fiction. Right, but for the time... But as the book, like, it's somebody reading today would say, this is very possible.
And are like, going
could, you probably could manufacture 100 of the same twins in the same
I think it's also interesting to see where our society has gone toward, like, in the book, like, they're, like, really for, like, expressing your sexuality and, like, just being open with that, mm-hmm. which is something that wasn't accepted yeah. back then, but it's something that we have really come around to. Mm-hmm. They, of course, do it, like, in if a really
outward,
like, excessive, like, to the point where, like, emotions just aren't involved in anything.
Yeah.
If but you... Yeah. I feel like they're taking ideas of the Roaring Twenties and amplifying them.
Yeah.
Which is, like, it's kind of the end of that Roaring Twenties era, the Prohibition. They're just, like...
And also in the Roaring Twenties, flappers were a thing.
Right,
flappers
so it's kind of...
at that time were so promiscuous and seen as almost vulgar, in
so
a sense.
So that aspect of the book might come through with, like, ideas of the Roaring Twenties.
And I would even say that Huxley himself is very, like, ahead of his time with the novel. I feel like... It was, even though it was a critique, like a societal critique on what was happening within the Great Depression and the technology that was coming, I feel like he also was very ahead of his time and kind of, not predicting, but giving a sense of, like, what we could go to and what we should be afraid of. That, like, there still needs to be a sense of morality within technology.
They're shooting for that utopia, but when you shoot for a utopia, you end up with dystopia.
Well, yeah, and I feel like that's the... That's the whole premise.
And, like,
I also think what Katie's trying to say is that, like, dystopians are also utopias.
Yeah.
And, like...
They're aimed to be a utopia.
Yeah.
The goal is a utopia, but it's not possible.
Like, a popular... Maybe, like, a popular kind of example would be The Hunger Games. Where you have, like, those people, like, the capital, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
They have, like, they're, like, super wealthy, like, dressing like crazy.
Yeah.
And time of their lives.
Yeah.
Meanwhile,
you get,
like,
those multiple
you have,
guys.
Like... Everyone else below them.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also think, because I was reading another article, which it kind of goes off what you're saying about dystopia and utopia, and the quote just said that, like, in presenting a so-called utopia, the most intelligent and free-thinking characters, that leads the most intelligent and free-thinking character to suicide. Huxley can also be considered an example of dystopian fiction, like his book can, because although it's a vision of the future... is less obviously bleak than many dystopian novels, and it's developed in direct critique of utopian novels, which posited that social problems were solvable, and dystopian novels maintain that human beings' inherent flaws doom them to misery. So I feel like even though it's a utopia, within a utopia you can never really reach utopia, because with, like, instant gratification comes almost a sense of, like, misery, and you never, like, reaching your full potential, because you're just seeking that, like, What is it in psychology that
id,
like, you're only giving into the id.
There's nothing, like, regulating that.
Okay, let's get into the genre some more of postmodern. Its role as, like, a postmodern piece of literature. So
postmodernism is pretty much a term referring to a certain radically experimental works of literature and art produced after World War II, which is perfect because this was kind of in the shadow of World War I. And it's distinguished from modernism, which generally refers to the revolution in art and literature that occurred during the period 1910 to 1930. And much of postmodernism, which is important to note, reveals and highlights the alienation of individuals and the meaninglessness of human existence.
Yep.
And this postmodernist frequently stress that humans desperately and ultimately unsuccessfully cling to illusions of security to conceal and forget the void on which their lives are perched. And I feel like that's kind of how we can bring in the drugs that they use, because a huge premise of the book is that, like, these drugs that they take, I forget what they're called. It's like Zoma, I think, is the...
Like, they're relaxing Zoma. And then the sleeping.
Yeah, like, they're... one of the characters is constantly taking it to feel some form of, like...
Of joy.
So it's almost as if they try, like, there's this meaninglessness of their existence, but they, like, desperately try to cling to some form of security, even though they're not granted that.
Yeah. Just, like, a huge thing of the postmodernist is, like... Is there meaning to human life, and how is there meaning?
Yeah.
And I guess they kind of just explore, like, the desolation, like, that humans can experience.
Yeah, especially with the lack of diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like he does a really good job doing that.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like Huxley's work, just in general, and, like, he has other novels where he's really just focused on this postmodern idea of, like, are we losing our meaning in human existence? Like, are we letting technology run our lives?
Yeah.
Right.
And I feel like that, like, A Brave New World is a perfect example of that postmodern, like, disillusion and experience.
Yeah.
And the setting plays such a big role in this, because on one hand, you have this perfect society where, like, everyone's happy, like, everyone's satisfied.
Yeah.
But they don't have that human emotion that really like drives the people in New Mexico who are like poor, like starving, like, but they have like a sense of like religion, of like community, like tradition, culture, emotion that the people in the new society just don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a huge commentary on like what makes us human and what brings us happiness and what should bring us happiness.
Yeah.
Right.
And I
feel like in the book there's a universal idea of what should make you happy.
What should make you fulfilled.
Yeah.
It should make you fulfilled, but like really you have to internally decide what's gonna make you fulfilled.
And I feel like especially if we keep talking about the pills and the Zomas that they take, those pills they're supposed to give joy, but like they never reach it. Like
it's just fake joy.
Yeah, it's like a material joy. And so they're not like they continually unsuccessfully never like find that like happiness in their life, so they're always void of any form of purpose.
Yeah, they're just trying to
fit in with the society.
They're trying to ignore the fact that they're not really happy. Yeah.
And that goes back to the idea of the science fiction that he uses. Yeah. Like they're modeled to be made.
Mm-hmm.
I think they do have some form of happiness. Like it's just not a deep kind.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind that will bring you like
it's superficial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like they're happy, but they don't have anything else. Like that's all they have is their like happiness.
Yeah.
And that doesn't go very far.
Yeah. And I would even say like maybe the like the relationships, like the sexual relationships that come from this novel, I feel like maybe those could be them trying to find that form of happiness in a way between like body connections.
Yeah.
In a sense. I don't know. I feel like that would be an interesting topic. Okay, so I feel like we should definitely move on to the summary because we've given kind of like an overview of how the story works and the themes of it. Ellie, would you want to give the summary?
Yeah, important to the summary is just like the premise of the society. We went over it a little bit, but I'll go over it again just to make it a little more clear. Everyone's separated into castes, and so you have like the lowest up to the highest alphas, like down to like morons, semi-morons. And everyone is made in a lab. Twins are made, like you have batches of people, like all the same. People are just genetically modified down to the T to be like a specific way. And in this society, like everyone has a specific job. And after like they finish their work, that's when the fun times happen. They do whatever they want to like just feel that instant gratification, whether that be like doing like the Zoma, going like traveling, having like relationships with like a bunch of people.
Instant gratification.
Yeah. So we start with the society, like we get a little introduction of the labs. We just get like a tour of like how this society works, how people are made.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note that in those labs, like they make like thousands of people that are identical, like embryos that are identical to one another.
Yeah. And in this society, pregnancy is something that's very frowned upon. That's something that's like disgusting to them. Like which will play an important role later in the novel.
I also think this is interesting, like within the first parts of the like story, you kind of like the director, and we'll go into the characters in a moment, but like I think it's interesting that he takes the like the boys that he's leading, like showing them this lab, into that nursery, and they like observe this group of Delta infants, and the Delta infants are just a part of the caste system. They're kind of like the consumers of the societies, and they're programming these kids, like these little infants, to dislike books and flowers, and that's to make them docile and eager consumers. And I think that's really interesting because it's almost like they're teaching children the morals of the world state and like a new morality to life instead of like what was once before, like in our time now. So it's almost like this caste system is programmed within the infants, which I think is a really important note because from infanthood, they grow up knowing this and seeing this within society and then following it through. Like their consciousness is completely taken away from them from infanthood. And I think that's kind of an interesting critique that Huxley acts on. Is there anything else do you feel like we should talk about in the summary without giving too much away?
I think we can introduce the characters.
Okay.
Yeah, and that will give a pretty good overview of the novel
in general premise.
Yeah.
Let's start with Bernard Marx.
Mm-hmm.
He is an interesting character.
See, he's an alpha male.
Alpha male, but the catch is...
his inferior physical statue.
He is shorter than all the others, like, kind of scrawny. Yeah. He is, like, as smart as them, but his, like...
his appearance is just off.
His appearance has really put, like, this weight on his shoulder where he knows he doesn't fit in society and he kind of resents it for that. So, like, he kind of... he's a very interesting character because right off the bat, he kind of points out all the flaws in society and he's very critical of it in a place where, like, that's really not seen. So he's a very interesting character to watch, especially as the novel progresses and his, like, status changes and, like, how he goes through, like, everything. He's very interesting to watch because he's just so outright against the society. But,
he's also very unorthodox with everything.
Yeah.
Also, what's interesting, this is from, like, an article. And his surname is actually Karl Marx.
You mean his last name?
Yeah, that's
what I know, but I don't like, you're just trying to be fancy there.
Sorry. His last name is...
somebody might not know what surname is.
Okay. Sorry to all the freshmen and sophomores who don't know what surname
is. What? I didn't know.
Okay. Well, now they know that surname means last name.
Last name?
If you didn't know before, you know now. You learn something new every single day.
But well, Marx is a parallel to Karl Marx.
Yes. And
as in communism.
Oh, my God. And that name was a monumental critique of capitalist society, which I think fits perfectly with Bernard and his character, because his whole belief system is completely against the belief system of the world state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I feel like maybe John we should talk about...
let's go on to Lenina next.
Lenina.
First.
Okay.
Lenina is your typical girl in that society. She's, like, not super high, but she's, like, she's fairly high up on the system.
Mm-hmm.
She's just your average girl.
She's a worker at the
lab.
Like, 75%.
75% what?
Sure.
Like, up there.
Yeah, she's pretty far up there. She's, like, just down, like, pretty normal. Mm-hmm. The one thing about her is... she decides to go out with Bernard, which makes her a little different.
Yeah,
because a lot of people would avoid him.
Makes her down to 70%. Puts her back down a little bit.
Well, also on top of it, the fact that she chooses to date only one person is completely against what they've been taught to do. So it's like, and this is a quote, it's intriguingly unorthodox.
Yeah. So, yeah, she's definitely like your average girl, but with a little twist. But I think you can, I think she's a really good example of someone in that society, even though she does choose to go out with Bernard, like, multiple times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As we meet, like, John the Savage, we really see, like, how much society is ingrained in their minds by her actions, and I think she's a very interesting character to watch in that way, as, like, you see, how people are programmed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I also think it's interesting, too, because even though sometimes her, like, actions are unorthodox, she still very much is a example of that society because she takes the Zoma, she seeks instant gratification, especially through sex, which she has with a lot of the men within the society, and she's definitely desirable to a lot of the higher-up caste system individuals, and I feel like that's interesting because even though she's giving into the culture, she's unorthodoxly doing it in a way because she's dating individuals one at a time, which is completely against what they would do, but she's still seeking that instant gratification of sex.
Yeah.
So
now that we've introduced those two characters, I think we can get into a major part of the plot that really sets the book off. So they go on a vacation to a reservation in New Mexico, which is kind of like this little bubble of the old world, where it's very reminiscent of, like, Native American culture. It's not necessarily, like, made up of Native Americans. It's made up of people, like, but of who have, like, a religion who don't adhere to that society, who are living completely separate. So, like, they have religion, morals, pride, culture, traditions, everything.
They're kind of an example of Native Americans.
Yeah. And there they meet someone who has a huge part in the book, John the Savage. So,
And John, we don't want to give too much away, but his character's background's interesting, so you'll have to read to find that out. But he's also, like Ellie said, the only major character within the book to have not grown up in the world state system. Mm-hmm. And because he grew up on the Savage Registration, he's unable to fit into the society of the world state. His entire, like, worldview is based on his knowledge of plays, which is kind of interesting because he quotes Shakespeare throughout the majority of the novel. And I think what's really, like, personally, I think what's really fascinating about that is the fact that Shakespeare is completely unorthodox, like, 100% within the world state, because his view of love, like, Romeo and Juliet, for example, yeah, is unseen in that world. But here is John, like, giving his love away to...
Creates a contrast between the two
worlds. And, like, he's so unhappy when he goes to the world state because here he is in a country where happiness is fake and he's never experienced that. He's only experienced the true pleasure of being... like, of humanity.
Another interesting thing about him is he is in his own society, too, on the reservation. He is also separated from everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if we want to say why.
Like, we'll leave that one for you to find out.
It's pretty straightforward when you read the book. But
yeah.
I don't know.
That's gotta leave some surprises there, you know?
Just keep in mind that he's separated for a reason.
Yeah. And he definitely feels isolated in both societies. And...
he has nowhere to belong.
So the main plot is they meet John the Savage. Mm-hmm. They take him back to the new society. And we kind of see how that turns out. Which is very interesting.
I also think another big character we should talk about would be Helmholtz Watson, the friend of Bernard.
Mm-hmm.
Because he, in my opinion, plays a really big role in helping Bernard find his criticism of the world state.
Yeah.
In more of, like, an intellectual philosophical sense.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Helmholtz is he's, like, the perfect example of, like, an alpha.
Mm-hmm.
Very, like, handsome, well-respected.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really have this, like, distaste for the society because he's been treated poorly because of it. Like, he is kind of on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But he still, like, finds, like, a way to criticize it, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I think his character, even though he's very small throughout the book, I think he definitely helps Bernard find, not his purpose, because I would argue that Bernard never really finds his purpose, but I would say more so that he helps Bernard see the discontent of the world state and, like, the meaninglessness of life throughout the story. Is there any other characters? I mean, the director, obviously, the director is just the head of the lab. And he's, like, that power and alpha male that is very much follower of the society, runs what they do. He's just very powerful, and he uses that to his advantage.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any other characters.
I feel like that's a good general, like, gist of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that's
good. Gotta leave some up to, like,
your own
exploration.
Yeah, so maybe we should move on to the author's style and text complexity.
Mm-hmm.
A big thing about the style of Huxley in general throughout his writing is that even though everything that he says and everything that he writes seems plausible, there's always a hidden message beneath his words, and everything that he writes is very detailed to the sense that you'll
understand
the characters to a full extent, but at the same time
you have to read into it, but it's obvious,
and he'll leave you questioning more, like, he'll leave you questioning society that you live
you'll want to know more.
Yeah, it's a very catching,
it'll trigger your curiosity.
Yeah,
I'll fuel that.
Think this is a big thing. So he jumps between scenes and repeated phrases, which kind of highlight the contrast between what characters might think they have free will and what they are conditioned to think. So, once again, his balance within novels, if you've ever read a different book of Huxley, is the fact that he finds a really interesting, almost symbolic balance between what is there and then what is thought. And I think that's a really interesting, like, stylistic choice of his, because it makes you, like, question your own self, but then still be intrigued by his book and question every move of the character.
Yep.
Like, there's never a moment that you read his novel and you think, oh, I get it. Like, you're always questioning his style and his writing. And I think a stylistic choice that's just very interesting, and it's smart, in my opinion, for how he writes this book. Because this book could easily be boring, in my opinion. But he found a way to make it very interesting.
Well, I think we should get wrapping up.
Yeah, I can
finish. We're getting to our time limit here, but you want to finish it off, Ellie?
Sure, we can do some quotes.
Yeah, let's just do a couple quotes that might leave you here, wondering.
Okay, let's start with their lack of individuality. As their children, they're raised to have a certain set of beliefs. When they're babies, they hear voices talking to them. Here's an example of like what they might say or what they might hear. Alpha children work gray. They work much harder than we do because they're so frightfully clever. I'm really awfully glad I'm a beta because I don't work so hard. And then we are much better than the gammas and deltas. Gammas are stupid. They all wear green, and delta children wear khaki. Oh no, I don't want to play with delta children. And epsilons are still worse. So here we have that just taking away any form of like individuality, told like, you are this, you can't play with this, you can't be this.
Mm-hmm.
You are kind of set. But also to be happy with your position, because you don't want to be anyone else. So I think you can see the manufacturing of people in that society, not just biologically, but also psychologically.
Mm-hmm. And then, do we want to do our quote, or do we feel like one is just good? Maybe happiness and...
Let's do one more.
Okay. I feel like maybe this quote would be good. It's all about happiness, and it's from the director's point of view, which is kind of ironic. But it says, and that, put in the director sententiously, that is the secret of happiness and virtue, liking what you've got to do. All conditioning aims at that, making people like their unescapable social destiny. And I think that's interesting because it's one of the first quotes you read, and it's pretty much him explaining to the boys how the lab works. And according to the director, who is a prime example of the society, happiness is conditioned acceptance of your circumstances. And I just feel like that's so interesting because this whole quote is pretty much saying that happiness is not something that you're supposed to feel. It should just be something that you're conditioned to feel to make sure everybody stays within check of the society. And it's definitely like a clear worldview, which like kind of discounts the possibility or the importance of human choice or agency, which is a prime example of the novel. So, yeah, I feel like...
And I think, like, okay, sorry, this is off topic, but, like, connecting it to kind of today's society, you see people thinking, oh, material things will bring you happiness and stuff like that. And I feel like that's...
Who does that.
Okay.
That's crazy.
And not gonna lie, like, I do it daily. But, like, if you go and buy... It's kind of... I would compare it to, like, the Somas or whatever. Like, The Somas. Yeah, sorry. They, like, think a Soma is going to bring them happiness and sure they'll be happy for a minute, and then they're all sad. And I feel like in our society, a lot of people think, like, oh, that nice car is going to make me happy, and sure you'll be happy for, like, a month, and then you'll realize you'll get used to it, and you'll...
Want more.
Yeah. Want more.
Like, you'll always be seeking that more
to
life.
More and more and more.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's, like, a parallel to the drug type thing. Like, people...
And this book really stresses, like, how important it is not to, like, necessarily be happy, but to find something more than that.
And also to find individuality.
Yeah, find something deeper than that.
Like,
Find something like, you're passionate about. Finding, like, pride in what you do. Having morals that you stick to, that you, like, deeply feel.
Mm.
Trying to gain respect, respecting others. Like, there's just so much more to life than just finding happiness.
Yeah.
And you can't live a fulfilled and satisfied life purely by just doing whatever it takes to make you happy. Like, there has to be some more substance to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this novel is just a great example of that. And I really would recommend, if you need to pick a choice novel, that Brave New World is a great one. It's fast. It's easy to follow. And it's also, it's just very interesting, and you really get to see a different side of, like, a societal critique on today, which was very ahead of its time. So I feel like if you like science fiction novels, you like utopian, you like dystopian, and you like conflict that's easy to follow and not, like, Shakespeare.
If you like, you're not all about the Odyssey, Yeah. Like, if you hated The Odyssey, go for this one. So, everybody. Yeah.
And if you like The Hunger Games, this is a more, like, a like, a very, like, literary
Or what's that other book? That. Yeah. That's, like, kind of like similar to the
Fahrenheit 451 or Slaughterhouse-Five. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would say this is a lot more interesting than both of those.
Yeah.
Probably What's more that easy other to book that's kind of, like, similar to The Hunger Games?
Divergent?
Yeah. Oh, or if you like Divergent.
No.
No.
If you're the one person that liked Divergent, you'll like this book.
Well, I didn't think it was that bad. I thought it was kind of nice.
Thank you for listening to our podcast.
Don't read Divergent, read Brave New World.
Or, like, if you like Harry Potter.
No, that is, it's not Harry Potter.
But, like, I feel like it's got that same adventure type feel.
Not really an adventure book, more as, thank you guys for,
I'm sure there's someone in Brave New World who has glasses, but I don't know if it fits.
Thank you for listening to our book talk about The Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. Please definitely read it. This is Kayla Bell.
Ellie Perrine.
And Katie.
Thanks.
Thanks. Okay, have a great day.